Let all the waters of Dune flow into the sand. They will not match my tears. This was a non-mentat excess, though, and he recognized it as such, forcing himself to sober assessment of present necessities. The thopter demanded his attention. The reactions of flying brought him some relief, and he had himself once more in hand. Ganima with Stilgar again, and Irulan. Why had Zia been designated to accompany him? He made it a mentat problem, and the answer chilled him. I was to have a fatal accident. This rocky shrine to the skull of a ruler grants no prayers. It has become the grave of lamentations. Only the wind hears the voice of this place. The cries of night creatures and the passing wonder of two moons all say his day has ended. No more supplicants come. The visitors have gone from the feast. How bear the pathway down this mountain? Lines at the shrine of an Atreides Duke. Anonymous. The thing had the deceptive appearance of simplicity to Leto, avoiding the vision, do that which has not been seen. He knew the trap in this thought, how the casual threads of a locked future twisted themselves together until they held you fast, but he had a new grip on those threads. Nowhere had he seen himself running from Jacarutu. The thread to Sabiha must be cut first. He crouched now in the last daylight at the eastern edge of the rock which protected Jacarutu. His Fremkit had produced energy tablets and food. He waited now for strength. To the west lay Lake Azrak, the gypsum plain where once there had been open water in the days before the worm. Unseen to the east lay the Bene Shirk, a scattering of new settlements encroaching upon the open bled. To the south lay the Tanzaruft, the land of terror, 3,800 kilometers of wasteland broken only by patches of grass-locked dunes and wind traps to water them, the work of the ecological transformation remaking the landscape of Arrakis. They were serviced by airborne teams, and no one stayed for long. I will go south, he told himself. Gurney will expect me to do that. This was not the moment to do the completely unexpected. It would be dark soon, and he could leave this temporary hiding place. He stared at the southern skyline. There was a whistling of dun sky along that horizon, rolling there like smoke, a burning line of undulant dust. A storm. He watched the high center of the storm rising up out of the great flat like a questing worm. For a full minute he watched the center, saw that it did not move to the right or the left. The old Fremen saying leaped into his mind. When the center does not move, you are in its path. That storm changed matters. For a moment he stared back westward the direction of Tabor, feeling the deceptive gray-tan peace of the desert evening, seeing the white gypsum pan edged by wind-rounded pebbles, the desolate emptiness with its unreal surface of glaring white reflecting dust clouds. Nowhere in any vision had he seen himself surviving the gray serpent of a mother storm, or buried too deeply in sand to survive. There was only that vision of rolling in wind, but that might come later. And a storm was out there, winding across many degrees of latitude, whipping its world into submission. It could be risked. There were old stories, always heard from a friend of a friend, that one could lock an exhausted worm on the surface by propping a maker hook beneath one of its wide rings, and, having immobilized it, ride out a storm in the leeward shadow. There was a line between audacity and abandoned recklessness which tempted him. That storm would not come before midnight at the earliest. There was time. How many threads could be cut here? All, including the final one? Gurney will expect me to go south, but not into a storm. He stared down to the south, seeking a pathway, saw the fluent ebony brushstroke of a deep gorge curving through Jacarutu's rock. He saw sand curls in the bowels of the gorge, chimera sand. It uttered its haughty runnels onto the plain as though it were water. The gritty taste of thirst whispered in his mouth as he shouldered his Fremkit and let himself down onto the path which led into the canyon. It was still light enough that he might be seen, but he knew he was gambling with time. As he reached the canyon's lip, the quick night of the central desert fell upon him. He was left with the parched glissando of moonglow to light his way toward the Tanzaruft. He felt his heartbeat quicken with all of the fears which his wealth of memories provided. He sensed that he might be going down into Huanui Na, as Fremen fears labeled the greatest storms, the Earth's death still. But whatever came, it would be visionless. Every step left farther behind him the spice-induced Diana, that spreading awareness of his intuitive, creative nature with its unfolding to the motionless chain of causality. For every 100 steps he took now, there must be at least one step aside, beyond words and into communion with his newly grasped internal reality. One way or another, Father, I'm coming to you. There were birds invisible in the rocks around him, making themselves known by small sounds. Fremen-wise, he listened for their echoes to guide his way where he could not see. Often as he passed crannies, he marked the baleful green of eyes, creatures crouched in hiding because they knew a storm approached. He emerged from the gorge onto the desert. Living sand moved and breathed beneath him, telling of deep actions and latent fumaroles. He looked back and up to the moon-touched lava caps on Jacques Routou's buttes. The whole structure was metamorphic, mostly pressure-formed. Arrakis still had something to say in its own future. He planted a stumper to call a worm, and, when it began beating against the sand, took his position to watch and listen. Unconsciously, his right hand went to the Atreides hawk ring concealed in a knotted fold of his dishasha. Gurney had found it, but had left it. What had he thought, seeing Paul's ring? "Father, expect me soon." The worm came from the south. It angled in to avoid the rocks, not as large a worm as he'd hoped, but that could not be remedied. He gauged its passage, planted his hooks, and went up the scaled side with a quick scrambling as it swept over the thumper in a swishing dust spray. The worm turned easily under the pressure of his hooks. The wind of its passage began to whip his robe. He bent his gaze on the southern stars, dim through dust, and pointed the worm that way. Right into the storm. As first moon rose, Leto gauged the storm height and put off his estimate of its arrival. Not before daylight. It was spreading out, gathering more energy for a great leap. There'd be plenty of work for the ecological transformation teams. It was as though the planet fought them with a conscious fury out here, the fury increasing as the transformation took in more land. All night he pressed the worm southward, sensing the reserves of its energy in the movements transmitted through his feet. Occasionally, he let the beast fall off to the west, which it was forever trying to do, moved by the invisible boundaries of its territory, or by a deep-seated awareness of the coming storm. Worms buried themselves to escape the sandblast winds, but this one would not sink beneath the desert while Maker Hooks held any of its rings open. At midnight, the worm was showing many signs of exhaustion. He moved back along its great ridges and worked the flail, allowing it to slow down but continuing to drive it southward. The storm arrived just after daybreak. First, there was the beady, stretched-out immobility of the desert dawn pressing dunes one into another. Next, the advancing dust caused him to seal his face flaps. In the thickening dust, the desert became a dun picture without lines. Then sand needles began cutting his cheeks, stinging his lids. He felt the coarse grit on his tongue, and knew the moment of decision had come. Should he risk the old stories by immobilizing the almost exhausted worm? He took only a heartbeat to discard this choice, worked his way back to the worm's tail, slacked off his hooks. Barely moving now, the worm began to burrow. But the excesses of the creature's heat transfer system still churned up a cyclone oven behind him in the quickening storm. Fremen children learned the dangers of this position near the worm's tail with their earliest stories. Worms were oxygen factories. Fire burned wildly in their passage, fed by the lavish exhalations from the chemical adaptations to friction within them. Sand began to whip around his feet. Leto loosed his hooks and leaped wide to avoid the furnace at the tail. Everything depended now on getting beneath the sand where the worm had loosened it. Grasping the static compaction tool in his left hand, he burrowed into a dune's slip face, knowing the worm was too tired to turn back and swallow him in its great white-orange mouth. As he burrowed with his left hand, his right hand worked the stove tent from his Fremkit, and he readied it for inflation. It was all done in less than a minute. He had the tent into a hard-walled sand pocket on the lee face of a dune. He inflated the tent and crawled into it. Before sealing the sphincter, he reached out with the compaction tool, reversed its action. The slip face came sliding down over the tent. Only a few sand grains entered as he sealed the opening. Now he had to work even more quickly. No sand snorkel would reach up there to keep him supplied with breathing air. This was a great storm, the kind few survived. It would cover this place with tons of sand. Only the tender bubble of the still tent with its compacted outer shell would protect him. Leto stretched flat on his back, folded his hands over his breast, and sent himself into a dormancy trance where his lungs would move only once an hour. In this, he committed himself to the unknown. The storm would pass, and, if it did not expose his fragile pocket, he might emerge, or he might enter the Madinat Asalam, the abode of peace. Whatever happened, he knew he had to break the threads, one by one, leaving him at last only the golden path. It was that, or he could not return to the caliphate of his father's heirs. No more would he live the lie of that Desposini, that terrible caliphate, chanting to the demiurge of his father. No more would he keep silent when a priest mouthed offensive nonsense. "His kris knife will dissolve demons!" With this commitment, Leto's awareness slipped into the web of timeless Tao. There exist obvious higher-order influences in any planetary system. This is often demonstrated by introducing terraform life onto newly discovered planets. In all such cases, the life in similar zones develops striking similarities of adaptive form. This form signifies much more than shape. It connotes a survival organization and a relationship of such organizations. The human quest for this interdependent order and our niche within it represents a profound necessity. The quest can, however, be perverted into a conservative grip on sameness. This has always proved deadly for the entire system. The Dune Catastrophe, after Hark al-Adda.
My son didn't really see the future. He saw the process of creation and its relationship to the myths in which men sleep, Jessica said.
She spoke swiftly, but without appearing to rush the matter. She knew the hidden observers would find a way to interrupt as soon as they recognized what she was doing. Faradin sat on the floor outlined in a shaft of afternoon sunlight which slanted through the window behind him. Jessica could just see the top of a tree in the courtyard garden when she glanced across from her position standing against the far wall. It was a new Faradin she saw, more slender, more sinewy. The months of training had worked their inevitable magic on him. His eyes glittered when he stared at her.
He saw the shapes which existing forces would create unless they were diverted, Jessica said. Rather than turn against his fellow man, he turned against himself. He refused to accept only that which comforted him, because that was moral cowardice.
Faradin had learned to listen silently, testing, probing, holding his questions until he had shaped them into a cutting edge. She had been talking about the Bene Gesserit view of molecular memory expressed as ritual, and had, quite naturally, diverged to the sisterhood's way of analyzing Paul Muad'Dib. Faradin saw a shadow play in her words and actions, however, a projection of unconscious forms at variance with the surface intent of her statements.
"Of all our observations, this is the most crucial," she'd said. "Life is a mask through which the universe expresses itself. We assume that all of humankind and its supportive life forms represent a natural community, and that the fate of all life is at stake in the fate of the individual. Thus, when it comes to that ultimate self-examination, the amor fati, we stop playing God and revert to teaching. In the crunch, we select individuals and we set them as free as we're able."
He saw now where she had to be going, and knowing its effect upon those he watched through the spy eyes, refrained from casting an apprehensive glance at the door. Only a trained eye could have detected his momentary imbalance, but Jessica saw it and smiled. A smile, after all, could mean anything.
"This is a sort of graduation ceremony," she said. "I'm very pleased with you, Faradin. Will you stand, please?"
He obeyed, blocking off her view of the treetop through the window behind him. Jessica held her arms stiffly at her side, said,
"I am charged to say this to you. I stand in the sacred human presence. As I do now, so should you stand some day. I pray to your presence that this be so. The future remains uncertain, and so it should, for it is the canvas upon which we paint our desires. Thus always the human condition faces a beautifully empty canvas. We possess only this moment in which to dedicate ourselves continuously to the sacred presence which we share and create."
As Jessica finished speaking, Titanic came through the door on her left, moving with a false casualness which the scowl on his face belied.
"My lord," he said,
but it already was too late. Jessica's words and all of the preparation which had gone before had done their work. Faradin no longer was Carino. He was now Bene Gesserit.
"What you of the Chome Directorate seem unable to understand is that you seldom find real loyalties in commerce,"